actually trying to live a good life under conditions of systemic injustice is very difficult. You're complicit in so many things that you can't just opt out of. You can't say climate change is the problem. Could I even opt out of the fossil fuel economy? No, you cannot live a life that is not implicated in some of the things that you might most want to resist.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. How do we learn to be happy with what we have and stop pursuing some impossible and unattainable expectation of existence? This constant striving and overachieving seems to plague Americans more than most. We end up being among the most anxious people on the planet. Is there a better way to proceed? I'm Mary Stack, and today we do have some help at hand in the form of two fine minds. Avram Alpert is a writer and educator. He's written the book, The Good Enough Life. He's currently a research fellow at the New Institute in Hamburg, and he's working now on a book about wisdom. Our second guest, Kieran Setia, is a professor of philosophy at MIT, and he has produced a book, Life is Hard. Setia suggests that trying to live the perfect life in difficult circumstances will only bring us disappointment, since much of the hardships in life can't be changed or ignored. So we need to come to terms with reality. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I kind of like that underlying concept of imperfection in the book, since many equate that word with something which is less than or substandard, and you see it as a kind of gift that you can maybe learn from, and you actually worked on that in your last book, the Buddhist approach of what imperfection can teach you about living well. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can explain a little bit about that and your sort of relationship with Buddhism as part of that journey.
Sure. And I think that for like a lot of people, when I first started thinking about imperfection, it was something to kind of bear with, deal with, you know, push through. Okay, life isn't perfect, but it's going to be all right, and we have the resources. And at some point, it really dawned on me that actually imperfection is this kind of gift. Because if we lived in a world where some people really could perfect themselves and really be better than everybody else, we would have no argument for equality. We could really say, okay, there's perfect people and there's imperfect people, and this is just the way it is. Our shared imperfection is what sort of says to us, no one is always going to have the right answer. No one is going to be more worthwhile than someone else. No life is more worthwhile than some other life. We're all flawed. We all bring something to the table. So our imperfection was this kind of sign of our equality and also of our necessary humility, and that these were not bad things, but these were things that opened us up to other people, that made it possible for us to form community with other people. Having the friend who's kind of perfect or tries to be all the time can be quite frustrating, right? But having that friend who's vulnerable like you, who's flawed like you, who opens themselves up like you, this can really create connections between people. And so imperfection is this path to the egalitarian community. And once I started to think about that, I also started to realize that, you know, sometimes we idealize other groups of humans or ways of being in the world. And for me, when I was younger, that really was Buddhism. I had this very kind of stereotypical suburban American, you know, I'm tired of these Western religions. Buddhism has it figured all out. I'm going to go be Zen and everything's going to be fine. And then as I, you know, studied and learned more about Buddhist history, I realized that, of course, Buddhists are people like all people. They're not perfect. They make lots of mistakes. Buddhist philosophy is flawed and complex and internally fraught in various ways. And for a while, what I did was to kind of say, well, I don't need to think about Buddhism then, right? It's not perfect. I need to go find this other thing. And I started to think, actually, no, it still offers these amazing insights, these amazing ideas, even the kind of modernized Buddhism that I received, the kind of Alan Watts Buddhism, it's still quite interesting. Once I stopped believing that it was perfect, once I stopped reading that it had all the insights. So imperfection was also a way for me to appreciate things that I think I would have glossed over otherwise.
So in your book, you say that, you know, we have become this nation obsessed with greatness. And the quote was in the book, "This vision of the world has given us an epidemic of stress, anxiety, inequality, and ecological damage." How did we kind of evolve to this state of being? Is there anything you can see as an attributable moment that changed us or made us more obsessed with this kind of idea, this myth of being great?
You know, one of the things that I found actually looking through the intellectual history, you know, the United States is this very capitalist nation. And there is something, philosophically speaking, in the roots of capitalism. I'll try to say this somewhat briefly, but Adam Smith, as people may know, is a moral philosopher, was the kind of father of capitalism, wrote The Wealth of Nations, but also wrote this book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. You know, Smith's point in that book is actually, it's not good to pursue self-interest. It's not the right thing to do. We should be benevolent. We should care about each other in the theory of moral sentiments. But he has a problem. And he basically says, what we really want in life is to love, to be loved, to be part of a community. Who do we see? Who is loved? Well, we see the great and the powerful loved. And sometimes we see that the wise and the good are not, right? They're kind of tossed aside. They're discarded. They're not respected as much. They don't get the same acclaim in society. And so people want to be great. And Smith thinks, and I think this is the kind of error, he thinks there's nothing we can do about this. All that we can do is find a way to have greatness work out for the rest of us. And so he sort of says, well, pursue your self-interest. You won't be able to spend all that you earn. And so eventually you're going to have to spread it back around in the community. And so Smith's theory is this invisible hand will kind of make the world more, you know, give it some enough equality, sufficient equality. And then what happens, I think, is that, you know, in the US culture, we democratize the wrong part of greatness, right? We don't democratize this idea that everybody is good, unique, virtuous, has this capacity, right? We democratize this idea that someone can be that great person who has too much that they then have to give it away. And once you do that, right, once you sort of say, we live in a democracy where it's not about sharing power, it's about having access to the possibility of dominating others. You don't really have a democracy, but you also have a winner-loser culture. And then if you're not on the kind of winner side of that, then you wind up feeling kind of on the loser side of it. This is part of the problem of telling your life as a kind of narrative, right? You sort of say, well, I'm a winner. I'm trying to tell my story, but I'm going to be the one on top, or I'm a loser. I didn't make it. We miss out, right? Even in this terrible system that really pits us against each other, you miss out on the plurality, the complexity, and all the other things going on in your life. So I think that this is a tremendous pressure. It really is on us, but there are things we can do in our own lives and how we interact with others to push back.
I think that we all must be aware of this idea about living in the age of desire and anxiety, how much pressure people that are under 30 are under right now, with this kind of huge expectation to be all sorts of things. There's focus on their image, on their appearance, on achievement. So I just wondered how you felt that young people were particularly being affected by this kind of onerous weight of having to be perfect and super achieving and have a TikTok video and any number of things.
Well, I was going to say, I do think there's something really disturbing about the way in which forms of interaction that are normally don't lend themselves to thinking thought in terms of greatness, namely friendship, kind of your social interactions where you're not trying to achieve something normally. Now you can try to achieve something, which is how many getting the most more likes on your post than you got on the last post. And so you get a kind of commodification that's not directly about money, although it can be, because if you get enough YouTube followers, you can make money out of it and so on. But it's not directly about that, but it sort of echoes the form of commodification and makes something that wasn't about achieving the most, and by its nature really shouldn't be about achieving the most, namely human connection, into something about human connection. I mean, the other thought about, I would say, about the condition of young people is, goes back to the ways in which negative emotions, I think, can be appropriate, which is, I think young people are right to be angry that they're growing up in a world in which their prospects are worse than they had a right to expect, in a world in which home ownership is extremely difficult, climate change is already here, it's going to get worse, jobs are increasingly polarized. There's, you know, terrible jobs and precarious jobs. And then for a lucky few, there are great jobs. But this is not a circumstance they should have to face. And I think that in a way, the advice I would give, although I'm conscious that it's easier to give this advice than to follow it, is not to just capitulate to the structural status quo in which, okay, that's the circumstance. I guess I will just have to outcompete the rest of my generation. That's the world I face, but to resist the status quo in which having to outcompete people is increasingly part of what, you know, the first 30 years of your life are structured by, that the increased need to sort of excel at school and on your CV and get into a competitive college. This is part of going along with that is part of a capitulation to a social structure that doesn't have to be the way it is. Mm. And recognizing that it doesn't have to be that way is, I think, really crucial. And this is something that I think Avram's book is incredibly great at doing, is connecting the political conditions in which we're forced to compete with each other for the kind of few prizes that are left, with the personal challenges of feeling inadequate and not good enough, and that those connections are there. So I do think Avi's way of thinking about this and mine really, really connect here. I was going to say, I was tempted to say great minds think alike, except I feel like I should say good enough minds think alike. That should be our slogan. But yeah, I'm curious to know what he would say about this, but because I think we're going to be on the same wavelength.
No, for sure. And, you know, I've been asked sometimes kind of, you know, what do you think is wrong with this next generation? And I think, no, like, they get it. Like, they really see the world that can't survive. You can either kind of have one of these lucky, cushy things in life, or you can fall to the bottom. And so, of course, they're going through the grind and they're going through this whole process. And I mean, just to share, you know, when I was teaching at Princeton, I came across this survey that had been done of British public school boys in the 1950s or so. And you know, they're asked, would you like a life that is meaningful, but you don't make too much money, or you make a lot of money, but you don't live a very meaningful life? And they say, you know, 80% yes, and 20%, you know, I want the meaningful life. I don't care about the money. 20%, you know, I want money. I did this, you know, unscientifically with 24 Princeton students, and it was entirely reversed. I mean, even worse, right? I got two students who said they wanted a meaningful life, where they didn't care about how much money they made, and all the rest said, no, money is what matters. And I asked them, what, you know, like, why? And they said, I thought it was quite revealing, if I had that much money, how could my life not be meaningful? Right? I could just, you know, I'd be a millionaire. Of course I'd have meaning. I just could do whatever I want all the time. And there was also, you know, there was some conceptual confusion, right? There was some sense in which, I mean, from my point of view, they were misunderstanding what that life of wealth would be like in terms of their well-being, right? Not in terms of understanding the politics of it, not in terms of understanding the winner-loser culture or the economy they lived in, but in terms of understanding whether this would actually be meaningful for them. And so I think it also goes back a bit, Mary, to your providing some spiritual meaning or just meaning in general, I mean, whatever word we want to use, symbolic meaning or just some sort of sense of a good life. And I think this is something that, you know, Kieran is doing this wonderfully, I hope also, you know, in his classes, but it's not something that we do all the time in the humanities, which sometimes shocks me. We don't always take students, these students who are yearning for meaning, a place in the world, a way to be better, and say, come to our classes, we'll teach you how to be a better friend, a better lover, lead a more meaningful life. You know, we say, okay, open up your textbook and we'll teach you about the 19th century novel or whatever it might be. Or I even said this at a conference the other day and was told, anytime that anyone has a conception of the good life, this is a form of tyranny. And you want to tyrannize your students and tell them how to live. And I said, no, I would like to debate with them and talk with them about this. And I think this is actually something that they want. And so I think one thing that we can offer to kind of push back against the culture that you're describing, Mary, is this, right? That we can actually talk meaningfully. I can't change the economy tomorrow, but we can have a serious discussion about what you want from life and how we can kind of help you find that.
That's actually fascinating to me. Because to make that leap, that because you've got lots of money, that would automatically translate to meaning. I find that an incredible leap, because I'm looking at the people that are in that echelon right now, Kanye West's and the other successful icons, and I don't know that they're leading a meaningful life in any regard. I mean, I think a really fascinating thing would have been who they really aspire to be and why. That's, I think, new. I think in the last 20 years, this kind of merge between pop culture, leadership, politics, influencing, being an influencer, whatever that is, that's a big deal. You know, you can have an opinion on something, even if you know nothing about it, but because you've got millions of followers, that has an impact, which is kind of scary.
In terms of the idea, I'm tempted to anecdotally say that at MIT, that I think for a while, the ideal was Mark Zuckerberg. Then Cambridge Analytica happened and the students were like, okay, turns out that Facebook may have destroyed democracy. Let's not go that way. Then Elon Musk was the next candidate on this list. And right now, I'm not sure that his reputation is quite surviving either. So there's a kind of pattern of investing in certain kinds of figures, certainly at MIT, where a lot of the students want to be tech entrepreneurs. And then the figures that they invested in turn out to be morally, socially, or in other ways problematic. And I think, yeah, talking about that is important, because a lot of the time, it's not that they're being told that's what you should aim for. It's that their education is about excelling at a certain kind of technocratic scheme. And unreflectively, you just start thinking, well, I guess success is a good life is just doing this really well. And if you don't have to tell them that that's what a good life is like, it's osmosis. And I think consciously pushing back against that is a very important part of education.
We've got some questions coming in here. Is aiming for a good enough life accepting things and dropping advocating, being engaged to address the issues we face? One shouldn't settle for incompetence nor poor qualities, says Deborah.
I suspect this goes back to I'll say something about this. It goes back to the objection that Avi mentioned earlier, that if you start talking about the good enough life, the suggestion is, well, it's about settling and accepting mediocrity.
Substandard.
And I think that's where it's coming from. And I think actually there's a key difference between settling in the sense of not trying to change things at all and accepting reality and thinking these are the terms that realistic change would have to start from here. You can't just fantasize about what it would mean to make the world a better place. You have to grapple with all of the imperfections of the world around you. And that actually doing that with this sort of broader view of what it would be to create the possibility of a good enough life in general, it is a demanding ethical project. At the same time, I think there's some real truth in the fact that we should be somewhat self-forgiving. I think actually trying to live a good life under conditions of systemic injustice is very difficult. It's hard. You're complicit in so many things that you can't just opt out of. You can't say, could I, you know, climate change is the problem. Could I even opt out of the fossil fuel economy? No, you cannot live a life that is not implicated in some of the things that you might most want to resist. And you can fight it, but I think it is also at the same time important not to be self-punitive about the ways in which no one of us as an individual can transform everything. And there is just the challenge of finding a line between saying, well, there's nothing I can do on the one hand, and saying, I must be a moral hero, a martyr on the other hand, which most of us cannot be. And I think that question of judgment, what's enough, is just the condition we're in. We have to make that judgment call.
I would just add, you know, one of the things I was reading, Life is Hard Today, and one of the things I think Kieran nicely talks about is just telling us little stories, right? So getting involved with a local MIT effort to push back on climate change. Because this is, you know, if we have this all or nothing model, okay, either I'm going to be the great savior, I'm going to be the Greta Thunberg character, or why even bother? Then we don't bother, right? You know, but if it's like, well, I don't know, I'm going to contribute my part and I'm going to do what I can. And, you know, you can call that settling, but I think actually you're it's in that positive sense. You're settling into what you're able to do in that moment and rising to the challenge of what that moment calls for. You're not having kind of utopic fantasies of a, you know, silver bullet changing all this, or you being the agent there. But just saying, no, I am also imperfect and I'm doing my best. And if I find other people doing their best and we get together, we can't change this tomorrow, but we can make some real progress. And I have found in my own, I mean, I say this, I'm not really giving advice. I'm just always reminding myself of this, because I start to feel very often, well, like, what's the point? I can't change anything. The gas that's pumping behind me is like, you know, straight from hell. You know, what can I do? But I think, well, you know, look, yeah, I can turn it down a little bit. I can talk to other people who are doing things in a more structural sense, trying to change the laws. And that's what I'm capable of doing. And that's therefore what I should do, not just kind of lament. Well, it's too big.
That's a very good point. So translate into action on some level, even if it's local. Yeah,
that's right. I think that collective action at every scale is part of the what has to happen. And I think, yeah, if you think collective action means politics, then you can vote, but you often feel like politically many of us feel fairly powerless. But then we're always part of little local at a school or a workplace where there's a much smaller collective in which you can make a bigger difference. And often that's, in fact, satisfying when you're actually doing something as part of a group it becomes less demoralizing and you feel inspired. And so I think from every, it's like it's a win-win strategy.
And the side byproduct is you're happier.
Right, exactly. I think this is really true. It's that doing something, even on a small scale, that you feel less impotent, you feel less powerless, because you are in fact doing something. It's just you're getting rid of the fantasy that the only way to have power would be to be all powerful.
And little things make a big difference. I think that sounds like it really does. Even if it's in your neighborhood or you can start a little action. I think you did at MIT, right? You worked with.
Well, I think this is paradigmatic for me. I'm not really much of a leader. What happened was that there was a student group, Fossil Free MIT. So someone was already leading it. And I just got to join and say, well, what help can I give you as a faculty member? And I think lots of us are like that. We're not going to be, heroic activists. But if there's a group that already exists, look out for one and say, can I join? What can I do? And have someone else kind of give you the leadership that you might not be able to provide yourself. And so, yeah, that's how it was for me, for sure.
Great. Well, both of you suggest that we need some kind of necessary stoicism to be able to lead a good life. And also determination seems to be a prerequisite. The Atlantic wrote a piece about your book, Avi, saying you don't have to be great to have a good life. You don't have to be a moral genius to live well. All you have to do is be interested, keep your eyes open, and not quit. So that's a bit of hopeful advice for everybody. I think we can all achieve that. And you, Kieran, encourage us to be realistic above all, which I love. I love the reality check. We should not aim for happiness or the ideal life, but to try and find sufficient meaning in the world as it is, to celebrate being alive, to cope with grace when life is hard. To live well is to treat not just ourselves, but other people as we should. And the first step in self-help is one that points beyond the self. A lot of great wisdom here today, chaps, in your books. There's certainly a lot of books about happiness and on how to live the right life. There is a podcast on the Stoics, which I know people that are listening to with great regularity. So clearly it's answering a need, I think. So any words of advice that you think, apart from, maintaining your perspective, engaging with people of like mind on things to affect change in a good way. So any of you got any suggestions about how you maintain your calm and serenity?
Well, I would say here's a piece of general purpose advice that for me was also kind of structuring the way I thought about living well in the book and what the project of what philosophy could contribute, but which really comes down to another anecdote, which is an experience that I have had and that many people have probably had, where you talk to a friend about something you're struggling with, and this will happen this Christmas. People will tell you, here's my problem. And it's very tempting to go immediately into assurance advice mode. It's all going to be fine. Here's what to do. And often that's a form of disavowal or denial. And it's not what people need. The first thing to do is to listen and just acknowledge that does sound very difficult. And often that process of listening is consolation in itself, but also that the willingness to sit with the problem, sit with someone when they're going through something difficult or they're struggling over the holidays, that patience to listen is the orienting thing that will solve the problem will sort of solve itself in the course of just sitting with it. And so I suppose that's a piece of advice that for me has changed how I approach difficulties in my own life. And when friends are going through difficult times, how I approach them. And despite the fact that this is a time of celebration, it is also for a lot of people challenging in the ways that you're pointing to.
Yeah, such wonderful advice that I often give myself, because I am like a fixer by nature. Like if someone comes to me with a problem, no way, okay, so we can try this. And as you said, nobody wants that, right? People want to be, sometimes people say, hey, actually, I need a solution. Can you tell me that? And then, okay, here's what I have. But usually it's, let's talk this through, or please listen, or just understand what I'm going through. And so if you, just to kind of make a meta moment on Kieran's advice, if you, like me, are a fixer and you find yourself going into fixing mode, forgive yourself for that. Step back, go into the listening, understanding mode, and you can start over. And I think this is really, again, the beautiful thing about understanding ourselves and our world as good enough, is that it's okay to make mistakes. And this is what, again, brings us together. Like that, I can imagine a friend in which I make this kind of fixed mistake and then I correct myself as bringing us closer, right? Because they kind of see me making myself vulnerable, see me going through this process of mistakes, understanding that we're kind of struggling through this life together. And I think this is a really wonderful thing. I'm about to go on a very long trip with a family with many different kinds of personalities and desires and interests. And, you know, sometimes I think, oh, I wish we were just staying here. I wish we were, you know, but again, this is part of what makes life kind of beautiful and wonderful and strange is just having all these kinds of experiences and interactions. And I try to remind myself, and I hope people out there will too as well, that whatever, you know, as long as it's not abuse, as long as it's, you know, not anything that we really need to stop, these annoying interactions, the kind of minor difficulties and things are, again, things that tell us more about what it's like to be a human being, to experience all the eccentricity and the wonder and sometimes the frustration. And so if you can kind of get yourself into that mindset of appreciation for just kind of what is, I think it helps cut the edge off a little bit.
That's very nice. Last point here before we have to start closing down. Somebody says the conversation to be had here about how an anti-racist worldview maps onto greatness versus good enoughness. I wonder if this has come up in your book talks.
Yeah, I mean, I talk a little bit about this in the book. It depends a little bit where the questioner is coming from. So I would want to know a little bit more. But I think one of the things that it calls up for me is this idea that, you know, if a world that is really pernicious and degrading for a number of identities, we need to respond. We can't respond with goodness, right? We need to respond with greatness. We need these great leaders to kind of pull us out and take us out of it. And, you know, I think I struggle with this in the book because it's a very difficult question. But when I started to dig in, the best I can say is that when I started to dig into the history of the civil rights movement, the Black liberation movement, the leaders peeled away. When you really kind of start to read these histories, it is exactly what Karen was talking about earlier. It's small local communities getting together, forming these networks that really have the power. And then when a leader is certainly helpful and can kind of galvanize that, but then, you know, people like Ella Baker, Barbara Septima Clark, you know, started to worry. Well, okay, so the leader rises out and galvanizes us, but what happens then if the leader is gone or the media just fixate on the leader and not on all of us? And what about the power that we're working for building together? And so I'm not sure, but if this is where the question is coming from, I think it is a complicated dynamic. But I think at the end of the day, you know, these kinds of organizations are not about having a great person leading us. They really are about all of us kind of working together and defeating these problems. So I still kind of, I do try to discuss this in the book and I kind of, okay, yes, good enough still works here. But I find it always an interesting and challenging point.
I think you raise an incredibly wonderful array of different questions for us all to think about. So I'd like to thank Avi Alpert, author of The Good Enough Life, in conversation with Kiran Setia, author of Life is Hard, How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way. So I'm just going to say Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and you guys. So you can go to the website, cambridgeforum.org, and there you'll find a lot of podcasts of this program shortly and many other forums. And I wish you all warm greetings and no arguments. Thank you very much.